I would say, you know, why do you have to do better? And then I thought of a way by which I could do better. One of the pupils in my form was Queenie Roth, who later became Queenie Levis.
Mm-hmm.
She married Levis at Cambridge.
Right.
And the two of us decided that we would not go into morning prayers and stand there listening to these others singing hymns.
Yeah.
We would say, on religious grounds, we object. Instead, we would stay behind, and she would test me out in Latin, English literature, chemistry. I would try to test her out in chemistry and so on. It was a sort of private coaching system with no payments. It was a mutual coaching, which we had 20 clear minutes every morning of the week. You know, it was a great help to me. I didn't imagine it was much help to her. But she thought, well, okay, all right. If he wants a quid pro quo, if he wants to give a quid pro quo, and this will satisfy him, then he can tell me some nonsense about chemistry. So I stayed on there, and I became a house captain. And then when I think it was the 1923 general election was held, parliamentary election, the headmaster decided it was time that the pupils learned about politics in the real world they were growing up, and they should meet and between them pick out three candidates, a conservative, a liberal, and a Labour. So they did, and they picked me as the Labour candidate. And then he said, fine, now what Labour candidates have to do in real life is address great audiences. No microphones in those days, no television, no radio. So the big assembly hall was made available to us, and we each, in turn, not on the same day, we each had a day to ourselves, addressed the school. All I remember about it is that the one question I thought was going to baffle me was Philip Snowden had said that he disagreed with the devaluation of the pound, and the Labour Party officially said it wanted to devalue the pound. And the question was, are you going to reconcile Philip Snowden's attitude to that of your party leader? And I said, it is not a commitment of the Labour Party to adjust itself to the views of an individual. If Philip Snowden wants to remain a member of the Labour Party, he will adjust his views to those of the manifesto. And even the teachers clapped that.
Your father must have been rather stunned by this.
No, he'd been allowing me to go, see, all this time, to hear Keir Hardie, and, people like that, David Kirkwood, Wheatley, Maxton, who regularly came to Edmonton. Edmonton was quite a political spot then. It was one of the first London outer boroughs to elect a Labour MP, a man called Frank Broad.
So, were your father's own political attitudes changing as well? Or was he just being tolerant of yours?
He was being tolerant. I mean, the furthest he was going, I remember once when I was already at the LSE in the first year, and I had to read Graham Wallace on Human Nature and Politics, and I was sitting reading, he said, what are you reading? And I said, Graham Wallace, Human Nature and Politics. He said, sounds good. Who's the author? Who's this Graham Wallace? And I said, he's a well-known Fabian. He said, my God, a Fabian? That's a politician? Oh, and walked away. But that was about as far as he went. Maybe he was right.
Yeah.
But no, he thought it was all right.
Mm.
As long as I was always able and ready on Saturdays to help at the stall or at the shop.
But did he run a magazine or something as well, or he used to collect money or something, didn't he?
He helped in his early days. There was two of them, you see. There was him and my mother's brother.
Mm.
Were both active politicians. And my uncle, that is my mother's brother, he really was a skilled workman, and his skill was printing. And he had a small little printing workshop in the basement where he lived in the East End, and he would run off leaflets, pamphlets, statements, and so on. My father's job was to try and get money so they could buy paper to run off these leaflets. And I remember him telling me about this fantastic occasion when he had a real killing, that they agreed that they should find some rich sucker and take his stolen goods away from him, all property being stolen, of course.
Of course.
And the idea was that they should approach, once they had found the idiot, they should approach him and say, look, you work night and day, and what have you got at the end? A few hundred pounds, it's nothing. You wear yourself out doing this. We've got a much better scheme. We can produce false money, which is so good that you'll never be caught. And we'll let you have it at half, a third of its face value.
Mm.
You'll see. And the man said, well, how do I know? And the father said, well, I'll bring some along. We need a little notice, because we can't turn this stuff off like this. I leave them a little notice. I'll bring some along, you'll see. And I'll stay here, or go with you, and you'll buy something with these things. We'll take it to a bank, and you'll see. It'll be so good, they won't know. So after a week or so, my father turned up a few coins, a couple of notes. The sucker tried it out, and sure enough, it was all accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it was accepted, because it was genuine still. So the man said, okay, this I will buy. You bring me a bag full of this stuff. And the father said, look, it's not all that easy. We don't want to get caught. We've got to plan it carefully. We will get on a bus at Gardner's Corner. The first one that passes, Gardner's Corner is in the East End of London, Orchid. The first one that passes after 9 o'clock, going eastwards. You get on first with your money that you're going to give us for our fake money, and go upstairs. I will then get on after you with the money I'm going to give you. We'll sit, side by side almost, and I will pass you my bag, and you pass me your bag. And then, the next stop, you get off, and I will stay on. No one will know.
Mm.
So, that is exactly what they did. And when the sucker got home and looked at this stuff, it was so obviously fake, so obviously counterfeit, he was absolutely furious.
Mm.
Found my father and said, you cheat, you swindler, you told me you were going to sell me good false money, and it turns out to be lousy false money. And my father said, yeah, I'm afraid you're right, and I think you ought to do something about it, but I will help you. The police station is just down the road, and I think you should go there and tell them that you tried to buy counterfeit money from me, and I cheated you. And I will go with you, and I will confirm your story that you wanted to buy this counterfeit money, and I was a weakling, and I fooled you. Shall we go now? The man said, you lobbers, you, which is a term of non-endearment in Yiddish. And the matter was dropped, but they had enough money for a long time. for some time.
Right.
But my uncle finally fled the country. Because he organized a strike among the sweatshop workers, the all women, in Leeds. Come out on strike, and he would chain himself to some railings as a protest, so that it made the headlines in the local Leeds paper. Well, sure enough, he did it, but all that happened was that they cut the chain, they took him off to the lockup, and I think he got 3 weeks in jail. And the girls all went back to work, and he went off to America. So that was the end of the partnership.
So you were at school still? You were
Then I went back to school, and then when I was 18, they said, you ought to go to a university.
What was your position in the family? Which were you, the first child or the youngest or what? I mean,
I'll tell you the names, and then if you want to expand on that. The eldest, the firstborn, was Nancy. Then there was Bessie. Then there was Lily. And then there was Ida. And then there was Joe. Then there was me. Then there was Hilda. And then there was Frank. That should make 8.
Plenty.
Oh, yes.
And what was your mother, what were your mother and father called?
He was called Abram. Abram Hills. My mother was called Annie. Anne. Right. She never allowed Annie. She was Anne. Abrams. Somewhere or another, there's a photo of them. It's a fantastic. How good looking my mother was then. And how respectable my father looked. Obviously, he'd borrowed the clothes from the photographer.
Yeah, yeah. We ought to get that copied or something.
Well, I have had it copied, and I sent a copy to every one of the children. And we will have ours somewhere in Brighton. And I'll try and find them. If I can't, I'll borrow them from Frank or Joe or someone. We'll have them.
So did any of the other kids go to university?
Well, the first one, Nancy, who ran away from home at 14, she didn't run away, she said she was going to Uncle Dave in New York. But effectively, she was getting the hell out. And went off. She worked, you know, waitress, amongst other things. But then went to Cornell University, where apparently she did quite well. And then she did a thesis on a relationship between a mother and her daughter. I suppose nowadays it would be called a sociological study or an anthropological study, because it was said in a particular context. Context being the Abrams family. But it was considered pretty good. And on the basis of that, she decided, to begin with, that she would be a tramp. You know, she just wandered around America and landed up in Chicago, went to the university, and a man called Edward Burgess, a grand old man of American social studies, particularly social gerontology and measures of life satisfaction, all that, took her on as an assistant, which was a great coup for her.
Yeah.
It would have been for anyone to be an assistant to Burgess. But she couldn't stand working solidly in one place. She took off again. This time she went to New Jersey, bought a little land, and began selling milk to the natives. Well, all the natives had their own cows in New Jersey.
Didn't get on too well.
She decided to sell her bit of land, and she'd heard of a place called Florida where fortunes were to be made. Land boom, all you had to do was to buy any piece of land, and in a few years it would be worth 10 pounds more. So she went to Florida, and the Depression came, and the land was worthless. No one wanted to buy any land, so she just abandoned it and made her way across country to California. And she really felt at home. There were lots of people like her. And then she thought it was time she had offspring. But she didn't want ordinary offspring, you know, too chancy. You marry someone, and there you are, you're stuck with his offspring. So she began looking around. She went to Mexico, over the border, and found the ideal father for her. In children, she was going to have a Mexican lawyer. So she put the project to him. He said, yeah, sure, fine. And they produced a daughter who was called Barbara, but now calls herself Barnaby. And she's now living very happily in California. She has a son who wrote to me recently and said he wants to do postgraduate work in economics in England. Should he do it at the London School of Economics or should he go to Cambridge?
Nice choice.
I said neither. Go to somewhere where life is real, like Manchester. I don't know if he took my advice. So that's what happened to Nancy. Right.
But just what the others stayed there, went into business, and
they worked in the shop, or they got jobs. With one exception. Then Ida became a singer. And
did she keep the name Abrams as the singer?
Oh sure, yeah.
She did.
Yeah. And this was really quite an event in our lives, because when she began singing at concerts, that's where you had to start in those days, little local concerts. She came into contact with someone who already sang in the chorus of Covent Garden opera, a man. And he had a terrific voice. Everything was the beginning of a crescendo, but then moved very quickly to fortissimo. It was terrific to hear him sing. He used to sing in the garden, irritate the neighbours. And he also had a habit of wearing a large little coat with the seams stitching undone, so that he could go into shops and steal things, slip them in his overcoat. And we were always curious as to what he would bring home. Sometimes it was apples, sometimes it was fish, you know, depending on what business was like. But Nancy, Ida, I'm sorry, took her singing seriously, and, you know, if she occasionally got opportunities, would bring in a little money as well.
And presumably your mother was very proud of this, with her musical ambitions.
Oh, sure, yes, she thought this was right and proper, yeah. The others didn't do anything, you know, out of the run of what you would expect from that sort of life. Then she married Lou, the machine gunner.
Did the machine gunner survive?
Until a few years ago. Yes, he got through the war all right. They had a son called Nathan. No one ever called him Nathan, he was Nate. And they came to me one day and said they had a problem. I said, what's the problem? And said, Nate has joined the Communist Party. And we wanted him to be a tailor. This will interfere with his career. And I said, well, there's nothing you can do about it. If he wants to be a communist, you've got to let him be a communist. And if you think it's wrong, maybe he'll think it's wrong later on. But there's no use saying to Nate now. So Nate went off and became a communist, but he did leave, I think, about 10 years later. So that's what happened to Ida. the other two girls, you know, got married, had children. Their husbands were reasonably competent workers. One of them was a gambling addict, and I used to earn a little extra money placing bets for him. He had a system, and he knew the system would break the bookies, but once they found him putting a lot of money on greyhounds, was his, right, they would get suspicious and they would ward him off. So he wanted two or three helpmates, little boys, who would go around to different bookies saying 5 shillings on this greyhound, and the other one say, go to the next bookie and put £1 on the same greyhound. He would pick out. His system was very simple, arithmetically. He would always back the greyhound that was in the third cage. He said, sooner or later, no matter how bad the dog is, the turn of number three must come up. It's the theory of probability, which he'd never heard of as a theory of probability. He said, if you spin a penny long enough, you get the same number of heads as tails. So if you have greyhounds starting, sooner or later number three must win. If I lose, okay, next time I increase my bet, so I get back what I've lost, plus something I gained from number three. And this went on, and the first week it worked.
Yeah.
I began putting my half crown on, and the end of the week I had £5. And at that point I said to him, I'm through. I know when enough is enough. This will never happen again. He said, you'll be sorry, you'll be sorry. The next I heard of him, he had sold everything, his clothes, the house, everything, and put his head in a gas oven and killed himself. So, don't take up gambling if you want a steady income. It doesn't work out.
Yeah.